Well, it's 5 o'clock here on the West Coast. Time to follow the pilgrim on the 405 as he makes his way home. Having spent the day blazing new trails and uncovering new techniques in the strange new world of sales. So here he is, the professional sales trainer and pioneer extraordinaire, the one, the only, Will Crist.
Well, welcome to the Pilgrim on the 405. We've been up and down the 405 looking at lots of different things this week. And some of the things that are really, really significant is that people are beginning to, guess what, spend money. They're beginning to free up their imagination, their beliefs. And some of the things that we've been noticing is that there's lots of different ways to see the economy beginning to wind up, to begin to take on the new possibilities. One of them is listening to service providers, because very often service providers, as close advisors, trusted advisors to business leaders, very often they pick up things that the rest of us don't see. So very interesting. Today we have as our first guest a man who you might not think is at the forefront of business, but because of what he does, because he helps close some of Southern California's top business leaders, he often gets a chance to have his thumb on the pulse of the mood of business people, of the movements that they're making, and of the various decisions that they're trying to make right now. So I thought it would be really fun to have Ron Vigiano, the president of Austin Taylor, with us. Ron, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, talk to us a little bit about what you're seeing out there as you walk around on the 405, the 5, the 15, the 101. Tell us what you're hearing.
You know, what I'm hearing is it's a lot different this year than it was last year, and I think a lot of it is based on either perception of confidence or actual confidence in kind of where the economy is going, or maybe not necessarily where the economy is going, but that we're not worse. Last year was a really difficult time, even for my business, and my business is the top 1 or 2% of the county. But they, you know, the people did not want to make any decisions. They did not want to hire or buy clothes, or even the perception of buying clothes when, you know, so many people were having difficult times. But I, in the last year, I have seen quite a bit different. I've seen a big change, and I see momentum going really strong. I even told my assistant probably back in 2009 that everything that I was going to be doing at that point on was going to be gearing towards 2011 and 2012. It just seemed like it was going to take a long time for people to get confidence, and I'm starting to feel and see the results of the work, and that confidence is improving.
Uh-huh. So tell us a little bit about, I didn't get a chance to tell people what you do, Ron.
Well, you know, I've been making clothes for 25 years now, Will, and what I do is I'm introduced to somebody, I get an opportunity to speak with them, learn a little bit about kind of their past experiences, perhaps walk through their closet, get a snapshot of kind of who they are, what they've done in the past, what problems or issues they've had. And then we can just, you know, I measure people. We talk about styles. You know, some people want to dress kind of traditional. You know, their business dictates it. Other people want to be more fashionable. Other people want to be more trendy. And there's distinct differences between all of us. So my job really is to kind of learn as much as I can about somebody and then help them make decisions going forward and build their wardrobe based on kind of their preferences and needs as opposed to availability when they were to go to a mall or a store or whatever, you know, the traditional way that men have purchased their clothes. And so I make all custom clothes from shirts and suits and slacks and sport coats, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Now, what I'm hearing is that one way that people can be well-dressed is they can go out and look at what's available in the store. You can go to Nordstrom's and even find somebody who will help you pick out what's in the store.
Sure.
I mean, I happened to drop in there today and take a look at Nordstrom's, and a woman said, well, these shirts just came in today. And that was as interesting as I think about that, because my imagination then is limited by what's on the shelf.
Exactly. That's kind of what I was inferring, is that instead of, you know, when I have a relationship with someone, instead of them having to rely on availability, and let's face it, we know men, for the most part, men tend to put off clothing purchases like the dentist, you know, until the pain gets so great, and then they try to make a surgical strike on the mall. And I'm categorizing everybody in a big broad stroke, but for the most part, they want to do a surgical strike. They want to get in and out as fast and as painless as possible. And what that does is it limits them to whatever is the, you know, if they're 42 regular, then there's 6 or 8 suits to choose from, or sport coats or whatever. There's, if they're a 16 neck and a 34 arm, you know, there's 20 choices maybe. You know, instead of, hey, Ron, Saturday afternoon, why don't you come to the house? Here's what I have in the closet. And you could look and you could see, well, you're really heavy in this. And my suggestion would be your next purchase should be this. And, you know, whether it's blue or gray or black or whatever. But you can make decisions. I've got 1,500 suiting materials. I got 2,500 shirting materials. I mean, you're only limited by your imagination, because nothing is made. You know, I'm going to measure you and make it for you. So you can have anything that you want. So instead of being limited by availability, you know, you can get exactly what you need for your specific occasion. All the time people tell me, you know, I don't have the right thing to wear to this occasion. You know, business casual, we're having our corporate function in Scottsdale or whatever. You know, we could build you outfits specifically for that, which is really nice. And, you know, that's why I deal with the top 1 or 2%, as I said earlier. It's a great luxury. And once you've done it, then you really get spoiled. And there's really nothing that's similar to the clothing experience, or buying clothing or adding clothing, than having it done in this way. And I think that's one of the reasons that my business has been so resilient. Like I said, last year, nobody wanted to, everybody sat on their wallet and they sat down pretty firmly. But, you know, once the fear was gone and they felt like, you know, the worst is behind us, they still go back into, it is a joy, and you know, they're fortunate to be able to do that, to have clothes made for you. Just, you don't go in reverse. You may put it off a little bit, but you'll eventually go back to it. If it's done right, there's just no better way to do it.
Well, that's not, now, so what really happens is, when you come in, you're helping people express themselves. There's got, now, help me. People aren't born imaginative dressers of clothing, are they?
Some are, and some, with all the teaching in the world, will never get there.
I think I'm in the second case.
Well, you know, it's not one size fits all here, you know. So we have, I have clients that tear something out of a magazine. They look at GQ or they look at Esquire magazine and say, oh, this is really cool, I love this. And so then my goal is to track down the fabric and measure him and put the right cut on him, because that style may not be the right style for him. But we can get the fabric, we can get the look, we can do all of that. Other people really don't have any idea. And the fact is that 21% of males are either colorblind or partially colorblind. So even if they had that style sense, they don't necessarily see the colors. For that person, we've developed a numbering system. And for those people, we can build a book. We would number their, I know it sounds ridiculous, it's kind of the male version of the kids' Garanimals clothes. You know, years ago there was something called Garanimals. Now we would put a number on a suit, a little toggle on the top of their hanger, a number on their shirt, a number on their tie, you know, and build them a book so that when they wore suit number 4, it tells them, these are all your options with shirts, and when you select one of those options with the shirts, these are all the options with ties. It allows me to be in their closet every morning dressing them without me actually physically being there. So, wow. You know, there's the broad spectrum. People that want to do everything themselves, and that's fine, and we could do that. Or people that want nothing to do with it, and Ron, you develop it for me. And that's where you have to ask enough questions about who they are and who they're in front of and what their style is so that you can, when you're dressing them that they're comfortable in the skin that you put them in.
Well, all right. Now, when you're working with somebody, are you helping them with their imagination about clothing, or are you kind of a human, a human shelf? I mean, what's in your mind is all they're going to get.
No, you know, you certainly could do that, and you'd probably be right 60 or 70% of the time, but you want to ask enough questions so that you really develop a feel for who they are, and instead of just one size fits all or my vision is the right vision, you've got to draw that out of them. And like I, you know, I mentioned, I've been doing this for 25 years. It doesn't come overnight. It just is something that you develop and you learn. And sometimes guys will say one thing, but they didn't really mean it. They just didn't know the right terminology. And you really have to be sensitive to their description and what they're trying to get across. And then I may say, do you mean kind of like this? Or do you mean kind of like that, and show them two different pictures, or use two different movie stars as an example of the style? And then you can really start getting a better feel for what they are, because you want to make clothes that represent them as opposed to my own personal viewpoint.
So tell me a little bit about what, I don't need to have names, but tell me a little bit about what you've seen as you help people move from, you know, from TJ Maxx and Penney's and Target up through Nordstrom's into your store.
What have I seen?
What happens? What changes have you seen in people's clothing imagination?
Well, you know that clothing styles, and I don't work really with fads. So let's take fads out. Let's just go through style changes, you know, like from Wall Street, the movie was a real big influence when that came out. And so people tended to dress flashier or really distinctive. And then, you know, in the late 90s, 2000, you know, the technology, or at least I can only speak from my reference point, which is Southern California, you know, there's a lot of technology companies, Silicon Valley and South, and that was kind of a rebelling of clothing, upper end clothing in general. So that was a very relaxed, casual kind of. If you were the CEO or president, you might have worn a sport coat with an open collared shirt and no tie. I'm seeing people now really going back to kind of tried and true business attire. I'm seeing people wear suits again if they were sport coat guys. If they were just Dockers in a golf shirt, they might be a nice slack and a shirt, a good-fitting shirt, and maybe even a sport coat that goes over it. I'm just seeing people having to, you know, lift their game up a little bit, so to speak. There's, you know, some companies just got wiped out, and the survivors are trying to differentiate themselves and appear very successful. Well, they are, obviously, because they're still standing after difficult times. But they really want to differentiate themselves, and they're going back. You know, they're having to knock on doors again. There was a period of time in a lot of industries where, you know, business just came to your door. And I'm not in one of those businesses. You know, I'm out in the county actively always looking for new customers. But there was a lot of my customers that they didn't have to look for business. It was just there.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're out, you know, and they want to dress the part. They want to look good about themselves. They want to feel good about themselves. And they want to convey a better corporate message, perhaps, than what was being conveyed when everything was so free and loose and easy.
So are you seeing, then, did I hear you say that you're seeing people go back to being more professional rather than casual?
That's what I'm seeing, and I'm seeing it on a daily basis over and over. Now, I'm not saying that everybody, like I said, everybody's not wearing suits and ties. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying people are going one step above whatever they had been doing. You know, if they were really casual, they might be putting on a sport coat or at least nice wool slacks and a shirt. And that shirt might even have a tie, maybe no coat, if they were just really casual. But they're wearing a shirt and a slack now. If they were sport coat or just shirt and a tie guy, now they might be wearing the suit. And if they wear suits, then they're getting new updated style of suits because fashion has changed dramatically in the last 2 to 3 years, enough so where it's not just it's not a trend in a magazine. It's really here full force. If you were to walk into the better ready-made stores here in Southern California, like let's say Saks or Bloomingdale's or Gary's or any of those kind of stores, what you're seeing is a radically different silhouette than what we had 3 years ago, 4 years ago. You know, we're seeing kind of a throwback to the 60s. It's a much narrower shouldered coat. It's really fitted. It's a flat front pant. It's a plain bottom without cuffs, side vents. I mean, these are all very, very different than what we were seeing 3 and 4 years ago. And so when they're getting their new clothes or when they're trying to update their image, the clothes that they're getting now are reflective of this new style.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, are they coming to you with that, or are you talking to them?
It's all part of that process, you know. I ask them, have they been noticing anything? What are they comfortable in? Have they been seeing the flat front pants? Have they gone to the stores? Is there anything that they, you know, has caught their eye? Because here's what's been going on, you know, in the meantime. When was the last time you bought clothes? If it's a while ago, then I need to really make sure that they've been noticing these things. And if they're willing, then I really believe firmly that this is what we should be doing. You know, I make them anything that they want. Some people want double-breasted suits. David Letterman wore double-breasted suits for 25 years. And he didn't care what was, you know, what was the style at the time. That was just what he liked. That was his signature. And there's a lot of people like that. And some of those people have me make them clothes because they can't find that in the stores. I understand that. But then there's other people that want to be kind of, you tell me, Ron. I don't want to be flashy. I don't want to be trendy, but I also want to be fashionable. I want to know what's up to date, and that's just not my forte, and that's where I kind of guide or mold.
Well, that's good. So you really become a clothing advisor to people.
Yeah. I'm their professional in that manner. You know, we've all got our attorney or our dentist or our doctor, and you know, I'm on retainer. You know, they've all got my cell phone. They don't pay me for being on retainer, but I get fashion emergencies all the time. And they know that they can always reach me, and that's just part of my business. It's a service business. And if you're not willing to give service all the time, then you're in the wrong business. I think that's one of the reasons that I've not only survived but prospered in a difficult time is that I understand it, you know. I am the clothier, and when they call, I'm going to react or give them the best advice I can or solve whatever issues. I always tell people, say, if you ever have a problem, just call me. I will be able to solve that issue for you. If I can't do it, nobody can. I got enough experience. I can solve it.
Well, that's wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about clothing. Tell us where you see clothing today. What sorts of things should men be looking at?
I am seeing a lot of, I don't know, the best way for me to describe this would be the 60s Brat Pack, you know, the Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin. They tended to wear solid colored suits. They tended to wear shark skin, and many of us have a negative connotation on shark skin, thinking that it's real shiny, and maybe it was back in the 60s, but a shark skin is just two different color of the same fabric kind of woven together, and it gives it a little bit of depth. I'm seeing a lot of shark skin, navy blue and charcoal shark skin solid suits with this kind of updated stylistic features, and that makes a solid suit, which allows you to put any colors underneath it, and you can really add a lot of personality to that suit by using the greens are really strong right now. Oranges and purples or lavenders I've been working with for like a year. And you can, you know, I'm looking at my ties right now in my office, and I have a lot of those colors because that's, I'm making a ton of that kind of stuff right now. And that's a way to really alter the look of the suit without having multiple suits. I guess that's where I was going, is that I'm seeing a lot of this kind of 60s throwback kind of suit, very narrow, flat front, plain bottom, but then adding personality through color. And the colors really are strong right now, are lavender and green and orange. Does that help?
Lavender and green and orange?
Yeah. Yeah, that's people are adding personality to their clothes with their accessories, as opposed to having the suit itself have bold pinstripes or colors or whatever. The suit is a pretty much a blank slate. And then because it doesn't have pinstripes or accent colors to the suit, just a plain color suit, you're able to do other things with it to bring in your own individual taste. Now, my more traditional clients, they're probably not going to wear lavender and green and orange. The lavender with the charcoal they would wear, but maybe not the orange and the green. But anybody that's a little bit expressive or entrepreneurial, they really are gravitating towards these colors. It's a great way to express yourself and still wear a business suit, a solid sharkskin blue or gray.
All right, so talk to me about shirts. Button downs? No buttons?
Not a lot of button downs in Orange County. That is a real yacht club, East Coast, old world Boston kind of look. You're just not seeing a lot of that. Orange County and LA County tends to be a little hipper, a little more upscale, and so it's a clean collar with no button. I'm seeing a lot of people wear French cuffs even without a tie. So you could have an open collared shirt, and maybe the shirt has some square Tattersall designs or some colored stripes in it, and then it's worn open collar because generally the tie is the you know your focal point. And if you're not wearing the tie, which is your focal, then then the colors or the patterns in the shirt tends to be the focal point. And they're wearing it open collar with French cuffs.
Yeah, I've been noticing a lot of that. That's interesting. To me, for so long, French cuffs were very sophisticated and something that you wore when you had everything.
Yeah, white starched, for you. You know, white and starched, plain color shirt, you know, red tie, French cuffs. But it's not that way anymore. You know, and people are, again, being able to express themselves maybe with their cufflinks. You know, a little bit of personality, but still that tried and true business. That's why the solid suit is really strong right now. And then, again, you're accenting your personality with the accoutrements that go with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So talk to me about ties. Are ties coming back? Are they going away? Are they getting bigger?
Ties are changing, and they're in the middle of a evolution right now, and I couldn't really tell you which way it's going to go. I have an idea. They have gotten slightly thinner in the last year or two as we have gone towards that narrow suit that I was describing to you. Ties generally reflect the width of the lapel. If you look at the bottom of your tie, it's generally within a quarter of an inch of the width of your lapel. So if the lapels on the suits are shrinking, the width of the tie is going to shrink to correspond with that. I just don't see them getting any narrower or much narrower than they've gotten. I don't see them going to that really thin Beatles kind of tie where it's an inch and a half, inch and three quarters wide. I think we're going to stop somewhere around three and a quarter. I just think that people aren't ready for that kind of radical change. But yeah, I've seen a little evolution in ties in the last probably year and a half, 2 years. My customers tend not to be the 20-something or young 30s that's wearing that type of clothes. My customer, my core customer, tends to be 45 years old, 55 years old, something like that. They're a business leader here, and they're not in the entertainment industry. The entertainment industry, you watch the the red carpet stuff with the Oscars and stuff, you'll see a lot of the people walking up the red carpet with these really thin ties. But, you know, they're in a different industry. They're not a business, you know, where you're seeing customers face-to-face, you know, so you can't be so trendy. You need to be understanding of the fashion trend, but not be trendy. Or at least that's the sweet spot of my business.
Mm-hmm. So not to be trendy, but be fashionable.
Yeah, and there's a very big difference between trendy and fashionable. Fashionable is going to be in style for years. Trendy could be in style for 6 more months, 2 more months, who knows? Mm-hmm. You know, if it's a woman's garment, it could be 2 months.
All right, so we've talked about suits, we've talked about shirts, we've talked about ties. How about belts? Is that a focal point, or is that supposed to disappear these days?
No, your belt's going to match your shoe. We don't see a lot of, you know, the braces back from the old Wall Street days. We saw a lot of alligator, crocodile braces, suspenders, braces. I'm not seeing any of that, but no, you need to wear a belt that's going to match your shoes, and that's not going to go anywhere. I'm doing more alligator belts this year than I did last year, but it's still not a, you know, it's not a high percentage.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you talked about flat pants. How about cuffs?
A cuff generally corresponds to a pleated pant, and a flat front trimmer pant generally has a plain bottom on it. There's certain kind of rules of thumb. It's just visually pleasing. Some people want to throw a curveball to that, so they'll have cuffs on the bottom of their pants just because they want to be different. But for the most part, those are pretty good rules of thumb to live by.
All right. Socks. What are socks? Over the calf, ankle, the colored? What's in today? What's not trendy but fashionable?
I will tell you that is one of those ways that people express themselves. For the most part, most people want to match their shoe, or if their shoe is a different color than their suit, then they'll match their suit. But some people, that's the place that they can express themselves. Whether it's over the calf or under the calf, that's a personal preference. And it's probably a 50-50. But I have clients that will wear pink socks. For the most part.
You have clients who wear pink socks.
I have clients that will wear red socks or plaid socks or whatever, but I'm not telling you that that's the norm. That's just their signature deal. I've got clients that wear bow ties. You know, that's their signature. I got clients that, like I said, still wear double-breasted suits. That's just they're comfortable there. That's their skin. So you don't want to take them out of their second skin. You want to keep them in their comfort zone. Some people like to express themselves with their socks or their cufflinks or their ties, pocket squares. You know, I'm doing a lot of pocket squares right now. Because people,
really?
That same guy that was wearing a suit and tie for the last few years, he's taking it up his one notch. And his one notch is French cuff shirts and a pocket square to match his tie.
Huh.
But I am seeing people really consciously paying attention to their dress. More so than I've seen in probably 8 or 10 years. People are starting.
How do you count for that? How do you count for that? What do you think is going on?
I think the competition for business, and they want to appear successful. They want to appear sincere and polished, and that they're trusted. And they're not going to show up in a golf shirt. You know, they're going to show up and say, "Hey, I'm here for your business. We want your business, and, you know, we're stable. We've always been stable, and, you know, we're a tried and trusted way for you to do whatever kind of business you do."
Ah, okay. So how about shoes? What are the fashionable shoes today?
Well, I think it's not my rule. It's less about fashionable shoes. It's a more of a pointed toe than it was 5 and 6 years ago when it was that real wide square toe. if I see anybody in those, I want to make sure that they take them off immediately, because we're just not, you don't see anything like that. But there's no real big fashion direction in shoes, other than you just want a good lace-up shoe to wear with your suits, and you want a good slip-on shoe to wear with your sport coats. You don't want to be wearing a slip-on shoe with a suit. You just don't do that. If you're wearing a suit, it's going to be a lace-up shoe. If you're wearing a sport coat, it should be a slip-on.
Uh-huh. Great. Great. Well, that's wonderful. Listen, I really have enjoyed talking with you, Ron. This has been very fascinating. This is wonderful.
I appreciate you having me on today.
Tell us, before I let you go, tell us how would somebody get in touch with you?
Well, I'm here in Irvine, and the name of the company is Austin Taylor Custom Wardrobe Design. And you know, just give a call, and you know, you can reach me at 949-752-6422. But you know, it's a fun conversation. You know, I'd encourage anyone that's, you know, on the fence. It's not about selling clothes, because I'm not a suit salesman. You know, it's a cool conversation. It's fun. It ought to be fun. And you know, people call me up, and we have that conversation. And then, based on kind of the direction of that, they'll learn quickly whether, no pun intended, whether I'm a good fit for them, you know, going forward.
And what I've observed, and I can speak for you, that it's always fun to be with you. You always have some great insights, and it's interesting to see clothes through your eyes. And I don't feel like I have to come in and buy something in order to have a good time with you.
Well, good. I mean, this is what I do, and I love it. And I'm very fortunate that at a young age, I found something that I was supposed to do. Some people takes a long time, or they may never find it. I found it at like 22 years old, and I love it. And every morning, I'm motivated to come in, and I have wonderful clients that are thankful for, you know, the opportunity that I get to build them really cool clothes, and I just love it. So that's probably what you're seeing, is that I just love what I do, and anybody who's passionate about whatever they do, it's great to have a conversation with those people. And I appreciate the kind words. I really do.
Well, I thanks a lot for being on the show, Ron. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Well, thank you very much. Have a great holiday, and thanks for having me on.
You do. Thank you. Well, there we go. One of Southern California's most fashionable clothiers. I encourage you to give Ron a call. He's lots of fun to be with and has great insights into how to look your best. And now, before we have our next guest, who is revolutionizing accounts payable for some of the largest companies on the globe, Fortune 1000 companies, as well as small companies right around the corner. We'll get back to you right after a short word from the SLMA.
Large companies with complex sales channels have sophisticated lead management needs. They require customized lead management systems and services, and integration with additional systems. That's why, since 1981, these companies have relied on SmartLead by AdTrack, the only full-service lead management company with customized systems for lead management, Salesforce automation, and analytics. These systems are managed by each client's dedicated account manager, and are integrated with SmartLead's in-house marketing services that include a contact center, email marketing services, print services, direct mail and fulfillment, and an ISO-certified warehouse. SmartLead by AdTrack. 3 decades of pioneering lead management best practices and systems for complex lead management needs. For more information, visit our website at smartlead.com.
The CEO and founder of Transcepta, and I'm going to let Ray tell me a little bit about what Transcepta is. It's a fascinating business model.
So Transcepta is a business-to-business electronic invoice delivery capability. We're a hosted system, so there's not really any software for anyone to put on any of their computers, but we assist businesses in delivering invoices immediately and accurately to their customers, so that they can leave one system electronically and come into another system electronically without any overhead at all.
So tell me a little bit about how that looks. Help me to understand how invoices are going to move electronically?
Well, so historically, invoices have moved on paper via the U.S. postal system. And in fact, I think the latest statistics we have come from 2008, which suggests that 80% of the invoices that move between companies in the United States move on paper through the U.S. Postal Service. It's obviously fairly inefficient. One system has got to generate an invoice. It's got to be stuck in an envelope. Postage has got to be applied. There's transit time. Then it's got to be opened by a mail center at the recipient's facility, routed to the right person, validated against the purchase orders, set up and scheduled for payment. Usually all that transit time and extra overhead, many businesses lose the opportunity to take advantage of early payment discounts because it's taken them so long to get the invoice teed up for payment. We shortcut an awful lot of that. The folks that send the invoices out, we basically allow them to send those to our data center electronically without really any change on their side in terms of technology or processes. We take that invoice, grab the information that's pertinent from it, reformat it, and deliver it in a format that is suitable for their customer to be able to ingest directly in their system. It happens virtually immediately, cutting many days out of the cycle and an awful lot of cost associated with both labor and consumables.
So tell me, talk to me about the cost savings that you bring to both the vendor and the buyer.
So there are a variety of studies that will tell you different kinds of costs of processing paper invoices. Some of the industry analysts that are out there have estimated that it's between, say, $2.73 up to over $5 per invoice by the time you figure the consumables, the postage, the labor for stuffing the envelopes and so forth. We basically charge vendors a very low monthly fee for unlimited invoice transactions, and of course it depends on the number of invoices that they end up sending. But many of our vendors are experiencing invoice costs in the few cents type range.
It's moving from $3, $4, $5 an invoice to a couple of cents.
Yes. Yeah, easily.
That is a significant savings.
It is a significant savings, but I think the thing that makes it more compelling for the vendor is the fact that the invoice is delivered in a valid consumable format for the buyer, which eases the way for the buyer to approve the invoice and get it paid more quickly. And as I said earlier, for those vendors that offer early payment discounts, it gives the buyer enough time to be able to react to the invoice and take advantage of the early payment discount.
You don't have any data on how much money people are saving by getting to that early discount, do you?
Well, since we don't process the payments ourselves, we don't have direct data, but we do have anecdotal data to suggest that folks are taking advantage of early payment discounts at 2 to 3 times the rate that they were before when they use our service.
Wow. So not only are they reducing their infrastructure costs, because these are just non-profit making. These are costs, right? Just cost of doing business. You're reducing that.
The savings go straight to the bottom line. They're just absolute expenses and overhead that you just don't need any longer.
Now, so tell me how you go about bringing on a client. What's the process that you use to grow your business?
So we start with what we call a buyer. It's kind of an industry standard term in the world of electronic invoice presentment. Buyer is the person who receives the invoices. And Transepta's target for those size buyers usually are folks that are doing multiple hundreds of millions of dollars a year in revenue up to, we have customers that are doing, you know, many billions of dollars a year. once we find one of these folks that and take a look at their accounts payable department, we'll find that they're kind of drowning in paper, that they're receiving tens of thousands of invoices a month on paper, and they have a staff of dozens, if not hundreds, that are dedicated just to processing that paper. Sometimes they have scanning solutions where they take a picture of the invoice and try to put it in their system. Frequently, those are paired with a whole lot of folks that read the invoice and type it into their the enterprise resource system, for example, an SAP or an Oracle type system. And they're looking for a better way. Again, there are studies out there that suggest that processing an invoice through for payment can be anywhere from $10 up to $50 or more per invoice. Curiously, it's the lower volume invoice producers that tend to take the most cost because their invoices are typically less well prepared. Less obvious what it is that the buyer is actually paying for, and so they get handled as exceptions. We're able to deal with an awful lot of that and take that out of the loop and deliver an invoice that for example, has all of the required information on the invoice. So if one of our buyers requires a purchase order and the purchase order needs to be a valid purchase order in this format against a PO that was issued, we check that out, and if what the vendor submitted doesn't match, we return it to the vendor and allow him to solve the problem so that he can get paid faster. He's usually happy to take advantage. Anything he can do to ease the process of getting paid is something that he likes to participate in. We even do such things as making sure the invoice adds up. You'd be surprised how many invoices that are prepared with office automation tools as opposed to real computer accounting systems don't add up because of an error on a spreadsheet or a Microsoft Word type application that didn't work. We do a lot of that that validation for them.
That shortens the time between the submitting the invoice to getting paid.
It usually does. I mean, if you take a look at the way, different companies' accounts payable processes work, many times when they get an invoice that is invalid, they won't even process it. They'll just simply set it aside and wait for the vendor to call and say, "Where's my money?" Hmm. Well, that typically doesn't happen until near the end of the process or when the invoice has actually gotten past due. We're accelerating that level of notification back so that it's moments after the invoice has been submitted into our electronic invoicing network. The vendor will know whether or not that invoice was accepted for processing, and there's no reason to wait. We also publish the status of that invoice, so the buyer, the folks on the accounts payable side, they'll update our system with, "We've accepted this invoice, we've scheduled this invoice for payment, it will be paid on such and such a day, it was paid on such and such a day." Vendors go to our web portal and call up their invoice. They can see exactly what status the invoice is in. Cuts an awful lot of phone calls down or emails between customers and their suppliers.
Now, if we were looking at music or the news industry or movies, we would call this disruptive.
It is a fairly significant change in the way that folks have done business. And what we've tried to do is make it disruptive in terms of the technology and its impact, but not disruptive in the way that processes work. Our unique technology allows us to take invoices that would normally be printed or emailed, and we can receive those in just normal human-readable form and extract all of the pertinent information from them and submit them to their customers in an electronic data format.
All right, so the money moves faster back and forth.
It certainly allows for that to happen. We clearly don't control the rate at which it works, but there are significant incentives, especially in the world of early payment discounts, for that to happen.
And so you're helping businesses increase the value of their money, the use of their money, the availability of the money, What does this do to headcount in organizations who previously were using, you know, the paper technologies?
Well, you know, the biggest impact is really on the large accounts payable groups that are receiving the invoices. And we have one large multi-billion dollar company that that within 90 days after connecting to our system was able to take, probably 65% or so of their accounts payable staff and repurpose them inside the organization. And when I say 65%, I mean it was over 100 heads that they were able to change within 90 days.
Plus all the resources to support them.
Absolutely. I mean, each one of those heads, you know, occupies space inside a an office and needs needs workstations and telephones and all sorts of supporting materials, and we're able to take that out.
So how did you get to Transcepta? I mean, where did that come from?
Well, Transcepta was an idea that was actually brought to me by my co-founder, Mitch Baxter. He'd been working in the world of electronic document management for quite some time. We developed a business plan, and we went out, raised a little bit of money to come out and test the business plan. Interestingly enough, we spent the first year developing the software and doing market testing for our business plan. And ended up spending the second year proving that we were wrong, the way that I think a lot of early-stage companies do. We attempted to only attack one side of the market, the vendor side of the market, and it turned out that we needed to be involving the customers.
So tell me a little bit more about how you got to Transcepta. How did you come up with this idea? Was it something that you knew you were going to do, or was it a set of ideas and you were looking for a variety of possibilities? Or?
Well, we actually started with the concept of trying to automate the way that vendors sent their invoices, and we built a lot of our technology around that. We thought we weren't being naive. We market tested it, did focus groups and so forth, and of course, like most early stage companies, still ended up being wrong. And it turned out that the missing ingredient was making sure that we involved the customers and had the customers kind of pulling the information from their vendors electronically. And it took us a couple of years to get the market strategy right and to get the technology right to support it. And we've been really kind of exploiting that for probably the last 3 years or so, and growing, you know, quarter over quarter at a fairly healthy clip.
And so are you on target now for everybody's got an exit plan or a liquidity event, something like that? Are you on target?
Well, our first goal is to run a good company. We figure that if we run a good company that has good recurring revenue and good profitability and cash flow, that a lot of the rest of things that happen with exit strategies and so forth tend to come along for you more naturally. But we probably, you know, based on my optimistic estimates at the beginning, we thought we had it right, spent 2 years really trying to get it right. So I'd say we're probably about 2 years behind schedule. And, you know, you know, the standard CEO crutch is that the market externals had something to do with that as well, and we've just come through a pretty significant financial downturn, and so a lot of our efforts went to make sure that we were able to keep growing through that downturn and emerge well-positioned as our customers have demonstrated more recently a greater willingness to part with some money in order to gain more efficiency.
So how helpful has the environment, the economy, technology, how helpful has Orange County been to your growth?
Well, I'm an Orange County fan and also an Orange County native, so have no desire really to work substantially elsewhere. In fact, you know, through earlier stages of my career, I had the opportunity to travel much of the world. Haven't found a place I'd like to live better than Orange County. So I think that Orange County has provided us with well-qualified individuals. I'm very pleased with the quality of the team that we have here at Transcepta. A lot of just really sharp folks that care an awful lot about trying to make a difference. We did raise some money externally from private individuals, and including, by the way, Tech Coast Angels of Orange County, which I was a member at the time. And so it provided a good environment to attract money without having to really go to venture capital in order to build a good-sized technology company.
So are those investors still on board?
Every investor that we have is on board. Some of them have participated through actual multiple funding rounds for us. But rather than go out and, you know, try to find $10 or $20 million in tranches from venture capitalists, we got nothing against them, but you know, there's a lot of overhead in terms of managing those folks and so forth. We have a lot of guys that you know, angel investors, and including me, I'm a pretty significant investor in here, who put much smaller amounts of money into the company, and they come by and check on us so often, and we keep them up to date with our progress.
Well, now you. This is a very entrepreneurial business, right?
Well, I think anybody that starts a business probably would say that. And the founders, all three of us that founded the company, are still involved in material ways.
I, you know, in visiting, looking around, I don't see a lot of stress.
Well,
either
that, or maybe you should have been here, you know, earlier in the cycle of the company. But the guys that are here in the senior management have done this type of thing before, so they recognize that there are ups and downs and so forth. But also, you know, the beauty of a hosted software as a service type model is that you've got a big flywheel to start turning, but once you get it turning, it takes relatively incremental pressure to not only keep it spinning, but increase the rate of the turn. And we seem to have gotten to that point in our existence. So, plus we got a lot of smart people, and they like working with each other here.
Mm-hmm. So, what's the future? Is it continuing to do what you're doing now and just getting bigger and more accounts? Are there places? Are there inflection points where something new will happen?
I think that there are some opportunities for us on the feature front to be able to broaden the efficiency that we can introduce into the exchange of invoices and the approval of invoices. There's an awful lot of effort that goes on today just to get an invoice into the system, and we take care of that. But once it's in an accounts payable system, making sure that it's appropriate and approved for payment and so forth is an area where I think Transcepta has got some value to add.
Now, this integrates, I assume this integrates, how easily then? Let me ask you, how easily does this integrate with SAP and Oracle and other systems?
The answer is very easily. We've integrated with a number of versions of Oracle and SAP to date. Those systems are typically built with the idea that data can be coming in from some external point, so we're able to do that fairly easily. I think that the thing that is surprising to most people is how easily we can make it integrate with the much wider array of vendor systems, the folks that are producing the invoices. And with the technology that we've developed and are utilizing here, we're able to connect up, gosh, almost any vendor in under a couple of hours. And, you know, our marketing says we'll get you connected in less than a day. I mean, the truth is you shoot us an invoice in over 99% of the cases, we'll have you connected up and live with your customers that same day. Usually, you know, if you send it to us in the morning, you'll get it back in the morning, ready to go. That's what we've done. That's our secret sauce.
Wow. So that must make it really attractive to the buyers.
On the buyer side, they tend to do a one-time integration with us, and what most buyers want to do is be a good partner with their supplier ecosystem. And so they're not looking to put any extra burden on their vendors. What they'd really like to do is help their vendors help them throughout the entire procure-to-payment process. And one of the main reasons that buyers select to go with us is because of the very low footprint we have at their suppliers. It just makes it almost a no-brainer for their suppliers to integrate with us.
So out of this little place here in Orange County, you are literally changing the way that major corporations in America, or is it global?
We have global customers, but our focus has been North America.
Right, so you're changing the way that major corporations in North America are communicating, working with their vendors.
That's absolutely true. We're quite proud of what we've been able to do.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that's congratulations. That's a significant. And just with that one company that you were talking about, if they were saving jobs for 100 people or just simply redeploying them, that's got to be, what was that number that just with that one account that you had?
Well, I think that what we saw there is that it was costing them somewhere north of $5 or $6 per invoice to process the invoices, and we've got that number down to around 20 cents-ish.
20 cents?
Yep, yeah, it's a pretty significant savings.
And they do a lot of invoices.
They do an awful lot of invoices, so there was a lot of room for us to be able to optimize.
So that's multi-millions of dollars in savings.
It's huge, yes. Yeah, they're quite happy.
And you're just going to move through the rest of the Fortune 1000 companies? Is that the plan?
Well, we're certainly trying. I mean, we seem to have established a fairly good footprint both in the world of aerospace. We've got a number of those folks. And in the world of really foods, grocery type places. We've got a number outside of those as well, because then what we do is essentially a horizontal service, but it's interesting the way that you start is the word of mouth ends up building after you've done a good job for one guy in that industry. He's at a conference with his buddy, and they talk about us, and we end up doing something for a related company. And then we start seeing overlap between the vendors. The vendor sells to company A, and then they'll say to us, well, we'd also like to deliver our invoices electronically to company B, and that's an interesting way for us to go to market as well.
So there's very little downside to a buyer putting this system in.
No, there's not. The upfront investment is very minimal for the buyer. They end up paying us pennies per invoice that end up coming in, replacing an awful lot of their costs.
That's amazing. Well, tell me, there's lots of entrepreneurs out there right now who are in the early stages of their projects. What could you tell them to encourage them along the way?
Well, I suppose the first thing is don't get discouraged when what you thought was the idea that was going to make you really rich ends up not being right. There's probably something about that idea that attracted you to it initially, and it may need to be refined or modified, but the essence of the idea should be able to carry you through. Also, I think you have to be very careful judging your success against the recent economic backdrop. I mean, it's hard for you to tell how much of that is because no one wanted to part with any money in a down economy, and how much of that is because your idea needed to change. I think that we've been fortunate here. We optimized our board of directors for really good feedback. We got an awful lot of feedback from those folks. We have a good network of informal advisors that I would encourage any budding entrepreneur to take advantage of. And then keep at it.
Now, my sense is what I'm picking up is that you weren't looking at how much money you could get from this to the exclusion of how much service you could bring to your customers?
Well, I think the two are fairly inextricably linked. I mean, if we were if if we were charging radically more for our service than we are right now, our customers would be less satisfied, less willing to recommend us to other folks. So you're looking for that balance. At the end of the day, it's not a charity, and we're here to make money as well. But we recognize that in starting a hosted software as a service type company, that the profits would be further out than if we had, for example, started a professional services company and were simply trying to bill, 170 hours a month at a different rate. We would have had better cash flow early, but not potentially be building as much intrinsic value into the company as I think we have.
Great. Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell the listening audience?
Well, I can't think of anything. I enjoyed the opportunity to be able to sit down with you. As I said, I like Orange County, and it sounds like you do too. I think it's a good place to live and work.
Well, how would they find out more about Transcepta?
Well, the best way would be to go to our website. It's www.transcepta.com. Transcepta is TRANSCEPTA.
Well, thank you, Ray, very much for being with us. It's always fun to talk to successful entrepreneurs in Orange County and hear their story about how they got there, where they're going, and all the wonderful things that they're doing along the way to make the journey so much a part of the destination. So thanks again.
Thank you, Will.
You've been listening to the one and only Pilgrim on the 405 as he wanders the world in search of the latest techniques and technologies to help you survive in the strange new wilderness of the 21st century. Only on OCTalkRadio.net.